Okay, ready?
Yes.
Okay.
Hello.
Wait. You made a face. Okay.
Uh-huh.
I'm ready now.
Hello and welcome to Talking Too Loud with Chris Savage. I'm your host, Chris Savage, and I'm joined by the one and only Sylvie Lubow. Sylvie, we got a great show today.
Great show.
We have Kip Bodner, who is the CMO at HubSpot. He's had an amazing career trajectory. He lives and breathes marketing. And obviously, HubSpot's been innovating in the marketing space for a long time. So we cover a bunch of that. We get into a lot of the heady stuff around what's changing in the marketing landscape. Where do we think it's going to change over the next 10 years? Where it's going to stay the same? We get into tactical advice when it comes to scaling teams. I mean, this is basically like a go-to-market therapy session. So lots of takeaways. I'm really excited for folks to listen to this episode. But first, Sylvie, I have to know, what's got you talking too loud?
It can only be one thing right now. It's the Olympics. Come on. Yeah,
that's what it seemed like. You love sports.
Let's go. I am cheering. I am crying. I am laughing. It's heroic what these people can do. You know, shout out to women's rugby. I feel like they're getting a lot of love. Women's gymnastics. Beach volleyball happens to be a personal favorite of mine.
Okay.
Love the digs. When somebody digs, oh my God.
When they dig for the ball?
When they into the sand.
Or they dive.
You,
got it. Yes.
Yeah. Digging, diving.
Oh, that's digging.
Digging. Dig.
Okay.
Isn't that it?
I got it. No, I understand. They're digging the sand up and they hit the ball as a part. And there's a ball involved, right?
Yeah. And yeah. Steve, everybody knows Steve, who did the horse and basically clinched the medal.
I haven't seen that much of the Olympics. I've seen the opening ceremonies, which were something else. Very insane.
Yeah.
Not appropriate for children with the Marie Antoinette part. And my kids were like, what is going on? What
is this? It was a spectacle. It was a spectacle.
Just headless, like, on whatever. But I did see the pommel horse guy. I did see Steve.
He was pretty great. It's just, I love the Olympics.
Olympics are fun.
Yeah. Yeah. What about you? What has you talking too loud?
There's this trend we've talked about on the show of people launching AI products way before they're in your hands. And another one launched just the other day called Friend. Did you see this?
I don't know Friend.
It's friend.com. They spent $1.8 million buying the domain name for this thing.
It's pretty good.
And it's a pendant that you wear with you when you go around, and then you tap it and it's always listening and it gives you like messages on your phone like you had a friend with you.
Okay.
I do not think this will be a massive
success. Who's the target audience? Yeah, like what?
I think they're trying to be like, people are lonely. We'll make you less lonely because you always have a friend with you. And it has this video that basically looks like a Black Mirror like episode. It was actually created by our friends at Sandwich. Beautiful video. Very eerie. It's like really, really well done for what
beautiful
it is.
Beautiful and eerie.
Beautiful, eerie, weird, dystopian, and it's going viral. Like last time I saw, I mean, it came out yesterday. It's got like 15 million views so far. It's probably going to end up with like 100 million views on this thing. So I think, yeah, I'm talking too loud about that. I think it's like kind of an interesting example of the times of people kind of, you know, over-promising. Will they deliver? I don't know.
Got it. Well, yeah, I don't know if I'm looking for a dystopian friend at this point in my life right now, but Kip Bodner feels like he could be a real friend, a true friend.
He does.
Kip Bodner friend
is like a real friend. He's a genuine guy. He's smart. He's thoughtful. And I think people are really going to love this episode with Kip. So let's jump right into it. Well, Kip, thank you so much for being on the show. So good to see you here on Talking Too Loud. And as you know, when I get excited, I cannot control the volume of my voice. This has been true for me since I was a kid. I am often told, this just happened to me yesterday, I was outside enjoying some fajitas And my brother said to me, "Oh my God, Chris, you're so loud. Like you're too excited. The neighbors are literally going to hear you. This is who I am."
But Chris, I want to interject here because I am that same person.
Good.
Loud and so we're loud. At double the volume today is what I want to warn people. Like every day I'll talk to my son and he learned sign language because he kind of spoke late in his life. And he's like, "Too loud, Dad, too loud, too loud," over and over again. And I have never been accused of being quiet in my whole life.
Do you ever have challenges at movie theaters?
Oh, yes. In any place there's quiet. It's like I don't have an indoor voice.
Yeah.
Can't go to libraries. Yes. No libraries.
I struggle. I don't struggle. I love going to see movies. I especially love like the popcorn kind of like summer blockbuster.
Oh, yeah.
And I am also an easy laugh. So like if there's something that's like designed to be a laugh, like I will laugh. And I keep going to things like with my kids and my daughter Zoe will like hit me on the leg. "Dad, stop it. Dad, stop it." And it's so funny to be loud and laughing in public and have my kid basically embarrassed because it just makes me want to do it more.
I was at dinner a few weeks ago with my partner and there was a gentleman laughing in the corner. She's like, "Oh, I found him. I found the one person that laughs louder than you." And I was like, "Thanks. Appreciate it."
That's amazing.
Good looking out.
Yes, that's fantastic. So I have to ask you that in general, what's got you talking too loud today? Like what's got you excited?
Well, first of all, it's summertime. I'm just happy about some beautiful weather, and I'm pumped about that. We've got our big event inbound coming up in a couple months, so I'm psyched about that. I'm psyched about all things AI and technology, and I'm psyched that we're kind of in this like era of outside of that 0% interest rate world, and we're focused on like grinding it out, doing real work, doing things of substance, and like real thoughtful people are making good things, and that is like a fun time to live in the world.
Yeah, it feels very different than 2 years ago.
Very, very different.
It is funny. We've been talking about that a lot because, you know, when I look at how our markets changed, like 2020 changed our market dramatically, right? Like made it obvious that your computer is a camera. And I think up until that moment, it was not as obvious. And so a lot of expectations for who can make videos and how they make videos and where you should make videos like changed. And then I think as the market became obvious, like, to me, it felt very early stage again, where it's like, wow, we are building brand new things that can work in totally different ways than we could before. But that was all happening with like 0% interest rates. And now It's so different just 2 years later, where what we see customers evaluating is like they are looking for something that actually solves a problem. They are looking for something that actually works. And I also feel like there's this challenge that has happened with AI that is like, in a way, we're like fortunate that interest rates are what they are and folks are looking for real value, which is like, it's too easy to like overpromise and underdeliver, I think, with a lot of these AI tools. And so I'm paying a lot of attention to which things are people like actually consistently using, which things actually create value, which things are going to create lasting value versus like the promise is incredible and then the product doesn't actually deliver.
Turns out growing too fast is bad. It turns out not having constraints is really bad. Like constraints are a good thing. They help you focus. They help you do better work. And everything you just said, like those are healthy constraints. Like customers being very particular on what they're wanting and needing and demanding that, like you make better products because of that.
For sure. You're more focused. You have to have trade-offs.
Exactly.
Actually, I guess that's an interesting question. Like for us, I mean, we're about 200 people, a little less. Mm-hmm. And we're building a ton of stuff and we're constantly tied with the trade-offs. Do you feel that at your scale? Do you feel trade-offs in what you're building and how you're marketing? Or do you feel, how does that feel today?
For folks who are like not familiar with HubSpot, we're about 8,000 people now. And it never goes away. It turns out, like one of my favorite articles of the last couple of years is Packy McCormick wrote a great newsletter that was... I think the title was Super Intelligence Abundance, which is like what happens in the world. Like if we had like really smart AI, like would it take everybody's jobs and all that? And he's basically like, no, it turns out that every moment in human history, humans just want more, more and more. And their capacity to want and do more just expands with the ways that it becomes accessible. And that happens in organizations, right? If you're a 200-person organization, 2,000, 10,000, doesn't matter, your aspirations expand to the scope and scale that you're operating at. So you never like solve that problem. It's just a perpetual problem. Or at where I'd say like an opportunity to actually say, hey, we can do a lot. And the question always is, no matter the scale, how much should we be doing? What is enough, but not too much? And like getting that balance right is actually very challenging.
Yeah, I think it is challenging. And it is interesting how the more you have, the more you want. And like, at least for me, hopefully, like the more you understand the customer, the more you can understand ways that you can help them, like other things that you can tackle, other challenges that they have, where if you know, 1 + 1 = 3, if you build the right things and incorporate them into your existing product and all of that.
Well, I think what's so hard about the time we live in right now is that we're like coming off of this 0% interest rate era where customers are very clear on what they want and they have a lot of real demands. And then we're in this new technological advancement era, of the era of AI, the third generation of the internet, where nobody actually knows what they want. And you need to build things that people do not yet know they want. So like you have to listen to your customers for some products, and then you have to like dream what is possible and give them things they don't yet know they want with other products. And so I think the figuring out how to spend time and money across those two groups of innovation is actually very hard. And I think a lot of companies have overbalanced one way or the other. I think right now it's probably more like 70-80% listening to your customers and what they want in the here and now, and having that 20-30% that's like a hedge against disruption and future innovation and everything. And I don't think you can over rotate to 90-100% on either one of those two buckets.
Yeah, because I think you're right. There's going to be ways we can solve problems that we couldn't before.
Correct.
But people don't know to ask for that because they don't know it's possible necessarily. So like, if AI is acting like a human being for little tasks and helping solve problems for you, you can basically build solutions that couldn't have existed before, but no one knows what they are. So there's this inherent risk element in it, which feels very early stage. And yes. You know, I think a lot about like, I was I think in fourth grade when we got AOL, and yeah. I remember being like, do you have AOL yet? And I was like so excited to have AOL and like tell my friends like my screen name.
Wait,
and
what
stuff.
Was your screen name?
I think it was.
This is important.
I've had a few, but I think it was like Chris S. MB. I went to a school called Moses Brown, so it's like just nothing.
Nice.
I had some others later that I can't get into that were gaming names. But I think about like when that was happening in the 90s, and then how long it took before it really felt like the internet was really changing our lives every day. And I think that's the question on my mind is like this stuff, there's amazing stuff literally every day. Like yesterday there was like 3 major exciting generative video projects that launched. Mm-hmm. But the question is, when will it be that like it really is changing our lives and changing our work? And I don't know if it's going to be 2 years, 6 months, or something's 10 years. Like how long it will really take before it's truly changing things.
Well, I think I'm somebody who's obsessed with the future. Like I am just really bad at living in the past or living in the present. Like I always want to live in the future, and there's a bunch of great things and a bunch of terrible things that come with that. But if you're obsessed about living in the future, then you start finding the patterns and the principles that lead to make those things true. And if you go back to that internet era, it wasn't just like magic and time that made the internet change our lives. It's like they were very concrete innovations, right? We use the cable infrastructure of this country to provide high-speed internet, right? We created really good Wi-Fi infrastructure. We had 3G networks that could make mobile internet actually scalable. Computing got fast enough and small enough that we could have really good mobile smartphones and do all those things. Like a bunch of things had to happen. And so as we think about the next future, like those same things are going to repeat themselves, right? Like those video models you talked about, for example, like part of it is just a function of compute and how much compute and the cost of that compute. And that's just going to keep improving, and it's going to hit the cliff at some point where you're like, yeah, great. Anybody can make a great 30-second, like A-plus quality video for free to little money. And we're just not there right now. I think most of those really good videos are taking what, like an hour or hour or two to render, and they're not cheap yet, and like we're not to the point of like consumerization.
Yes. Yeah, totally. I think you're spot on that it is about those foundational changes, and that like it's trying to figure out to your point, what are the limitations, and what are the limitations going to change, and how do you, which world should you be building for? Should you be building for the world that we're going to be in for the, let's say, 3 years of transition to this stuff, or should you be building for the world that's like the post transition, what it is free and it is unlimited? And I think that's like, those are really interesting questions to try to figure out. And at least for me, my strategy is like, use all the stuff, like actively be the early adopter and actually judge myself. Is this actually good? Is it getting better at the right clip? Do I believe, like, when do I believe these changes will show up as being, when will the technology be good enough to really change how we think about
problems? I think that's great advice. I have like, what is the simplest principle, but tends to work very well, that the second my time or capital allocation changes in a meaningful way, we're here.
Yeah.
Right. And like, I look back, it's like, oh, I went from like spending no money on Uber to like $300 a month on Uber, decade ago. And it's like, and that was my look back of like, oh, I should have just like begged, pleaded and stealed for private shares of Uber, because like I knew at that point it was like a real thing. Same thing that happened with Zoom. It's like, even pre-pandemic, it's like, oh, Zoom's a thing. I bought the IPO because I'm like, oh, great. This is like clearly how we're going to like transform how we work and how we communicate. And it's just like, if you're out there using everything, then you notice like, oh gosh, I'm now using this thing like 20 minutes a day. I wasn't using it at all. Like, this is actually probably very, very important technology.
I love that way of thinking about it. And I think it's also interesting because behavior changes so hard.
Very hard. It's like the highest bar.
Yeah. I think that's a really interesting question for people to ask themselves in general. Like, you're trying to use all this new stuff. Like, how much are you actually using it? Like, and if you are using it a lot, if you have changed behavior, then the thing is probably coming.
Yeah, you're probably ahead of everybody else. It's probably going to get real adoption, and it's going to be a part of our society for some period of time. Yeah, right.
Wow, we could just talk only about this, and I have an instinct too, but I have a lot of other things I want to ask you.
Yes, I was told there are real questions.
There's business, real questions,
marketing advice questions. I'm here for them.
I just want to talk a little bit. So you've been the CMO at HubSpot for 9 years.
I have.
But you started as a content marketer at HubSpot.
I did. So,
writing blog posts and guides and all that kind of stuff. First of all, that's insane and amazing. Like, so cool to see someone with your trajectory and to see what you're doing now is like awesome. So congratulations.
Thank you.
But also, I'm wondering, when you look on your experience, I think a lot of people would love to have the career that you've had. Mm-hmm. And what do you look at from that time? Like, what stuff has stayed the same and what things have changed? Like, what's changing for you?
Yeah, so for folks, I don't know if you've read it, like Morgan Housel's book that came out earlier this year, Same As Ever, I thought was really good, was all about the things that never change, right? And so we can do a little Same As Ever for marketing. Like, what are the things that don't change in marketing? Turns out needing to know how to write never changes, right? Like, turns out having a deep understanding of what your audience/customer is interested in and wants, and like mapping what you want to achieve to what they want, like, that never changes. Like, you always have to figure out clever and creative ways to do that. Like, that is very, very clear. Turns out consistency never changes. Like, you got to commit to doing things and doing things for a long time. Like, people are like, oh, why have you been CMO at HubSpot for so long? It's like, because it takes a really long time to do great things. Turns out great things are not fast. Like, it takes a really, really long time to do great things. And most people do not fail because they're not smart enough. They fail because they're not enduring and persistent enough over a long enough time horizon. And that has just never been more true in marketing, will always be true in marketing. It's like, if apathy is the enemy of all marketing, people just not caring, not knowing about you, then the anecdote to that is like, you show up, and you beat people into submission of like, hey, you are going to know and have some form of care about me because I am going to be here and I'm going to be a part of your life over and over and over again, right?
I love that and could not agree more. Like, it's something I say all the time, is like, to solve hard problems, you have to work on them for a long time. And like, the secret is the long time thing, and like, people actually enduring and being persistent. So love that. I was nodding aggressively for those listening to the podcast during what Kip was just saying. How do you think about growth actually, let me put it this way. Mm-hmm. When you think about growth, how much would you weigh searching for new levers of growth, like new opportunities, new channels, versus nurturing compounding initiatives?
I think it's kind of a false choice, right? And to me, what growth is, if you're a marketer, there are kind of a couple other same as evers, is your job is to figure out, I'm going to give you a story and I promise it's going to come back to it. Over the pandemic, it was a dark time. I was having a tough time like everybody else. And I wanted to like obsess about something because that's just kind of who I am. So I was like, you know what? I know nothing about art. I want to obsess about art and just like learn contemporary art. And I took like 18 months and learned like the entire world of contemporary art. And I just cold call art dealers up and like talk to them for like half hour, oh, wow, hour, and ask them a bunch of questions and like figure out like, how does pricing work? How do these people do all these things? And in that, like I ended up talking to this interesting guy from London, and he was like, look, anybody who's ever made a generational collection of art, all they've done is bought art from their contemporaries, the people of their age. Like they started in their 20s, they bought art from their contemporaries, they did it for 20 to 30 years. And if you look at every like monumental collection of art in the history of the world, that's basically the genesis of it across generations. The same thing applies to growth and marketing. Is you have to pick the opportunities of your cohort, of your generation, of like, if you're starting a company today, your marketing channels are going to look very different than if you started a company 5 years ago or 10 years ago. And so part of it is like, you want to be early to channels, because when you're early to channels, like I love living in the future because I get VCs to give me like leverage in my life, right? Like if I'm a startup customer, VCs are supplementing my consumption of that product because that product is probably underpriced and a whole host of things. Same thing with marketing. I want to be in a channel where it's the saturation is low and I think the potential is high. And then if I've selected that, Chris, then it is the I then have to focus on grinding out and compounding that. For HubSpot, that was Google Search. HubSpot started when Google Search was very early. And so we compounded it over the course of 15 years because like it was a channel of our contemporaries, of who we were, and we built that and we did that. What I find where people go wrong with growing is like, cool, I'm a startup. I'm going to invest a bunch of my time in email marketing. It's like, look, I can tell you the click-through rate of your emails. It's going to be somewhere between 1.9% and 3.2%, right? Like I can tell you exactly, like you are fighting to be on the big end of that narrow spread. Wouldn't you rather go do something where the spread is much wider, where you have the opportunity, like the beta is much wider so that you can actually have real upside? Like I think of it as like you're a venture capitalist. You wouldn't invest in like companies who are growing slow with small markets. You would invest in, oh, these are companies doing new disruptive things in really big markets. They're going to create new opportunity. That's where I want to invest my money. It's also kind of how I want to think about my marketing channels or my growth channels.
I saw an interview that you did once where you're talking about how many channels you need to scale. Yeah. And you basically said something, I'm going to paraphrase it, but it was like, to get to 50 million in revenue, you really need like one channel working. To get to 100 million, you need two. And then really to scale beyond that, you need three. And I remember when I saw that clip, it really resonated with me because like we had had this experience of we had some channels that were working. We probably added too many. Mm-hmm. And we didn't double down on ones that were working. And some of the simple things that we did to like move the numbers on growth more was just double down on stuff that worked before. I assume you still believe this.
I definitely do.
Yeah. Can you explain better than I just did, like how people should think about, I think specifically, when do you add more channels in? Like when should you broaden versus double down? Or is the goal just to do both?
Yeah. So I'm going to give everybody a few cheat sheets before I actually answer that specific question, which is like, most human beings think opportunities are much smaller than they are. Most opportunities are much bigger than people think. Most human beings think that the downside is really, really, really big and the upside's very limited. The opposite is almost always the truth. The downside is almost always less than what you think, and the upside is almost always a lot more than what you think. And it sounds silly, but changing your mindset around those two things is the leading indicator of answering that question that you just asked correctly, right? Because you're like, okay, I have to have an abundance mindset versus a scarcity mindset. I have to think that this is could be much bigger if I was one of the best people in the world at it. Because what I believe in that 1-2-3 channel model is like, that's all true if you're willing to be one of the best people in the world at those things, right? If you're going to be average at those things, you need 10 channels. But if you're willing to be one of the best people in the world at those things, top 1%, then you only need 1, 2, or 3 channels as you kind of scale. And so I think kind of the original question here is like, how do you think about when do you need a new channel? You need a new channel when either you lack skill and expertise to grow that channel anymore, and that's actually the reason most people do, where you have lost focus of the goal and pragmatism of what you'd originally committed to. Most people don't grow because they don't know how. They just get bored or interested in something else. Like, the people I admire most in this world are the people who will just put their head down and do the same thing for 5-10 years, where you're like, no, I know this works, and I will do this and compound this, even if it seems super monotonous, because the end payoff is going to be much, much greater. And I found that to always be true. It's just actually very hard to practice. Then the third reason, which is the only actual like tactical reason, is if the economics of that channel are breaking. And that normally is very specific to paid performance marketing, right? Where you can build a $50 million business off paid performance marketing because you can essentially get the cost structure to work. But as you have to grow and you have to expand and widen your targeting, the costs inflate so much that the unit economics and your return on ad spend just start breaking. And then you have to go look for new channels. And so the economics of your channel start to feel like they're breaking. That's really when you have to get there. Because economics either break because I'm not getting enough volume, and then that's a good reason to go do something else. Or the volume I'm getting is getting more and more expensive, which is the case in paid. And one of those two things is when you need to go get a new channel.
And do you think the other piece of the puzzle there is back to the world-class thing of like looking at that through that lens to understand why maybe a channel isn't performing the way it used to?
Yeah. So the first thing I would say is if you're going down the path of like, oh, maybe this is not working anymore, or it's limited in the way it's working, I would ask myself a series of questions. I'd be like, self, am I completely inward focused? Is the way we're doing this based on what we've done in the past and what I think? And if so, like, that's a bad way to do things. It's a bad way to live. And if that answer is normally yes. Like, if things are not going well, the answer to that question is normally yes. And if that question is yes, then you would say, all right, I must now go and learn from some of the people who are the best people in the world at this thing to see where the gap is from where I am to where they are. And so I can understand, is that a small, tiny gap and I need to be worried? Or is it a big gap and I'm like, yeah, this is my fault and I just need to change what I'm doing? And so what I would normally do is find 5 to 10 people who I think are world-class at that thing, and I would get on Zoom or fly to them, and I would ask them for an hour where I can just ask them questions. And in turn, I would give them anything they wanted. I'd offer to pay them whatever hourly rate they wanted. I would, I would offer to do a favor for them, whatever, to do that. And coming out of that, you then have like a very valuable set of data and information to go and make an informed choice about like why you're not where you want to be with that strategy.
There's a lot of wisdom just dropped there, I think. And I use that word specifically because I think like you just said a lot of stuff that I think is very hard won. That's like almost like not that hard to say, but hard to recognize like the impact of it.
Very hard to do. It's very uncomfortable.
Yes, it is. It is uncomfortable.
How do you both, because both of you seem like you enjoy working on the same problem for a long time. So how do you have that like internal trust? And then like, how do you inspire teams to also like go on this journey with you if they're not seeing like immediate payoff?
Immediacy is very hard, right? Humans, we love immediacy. The flip side is if you're making no immediate progress, you're also doing a bad job, right? Like the long grind is about making quick progress that you know that you can sustain for a long period of time. It would be like, cool, I was running a 20-minute mile, now I'm running a 12-minute mile. Can I run a 12-minute mile for half marathon? You know, like that is like, that's like a big step and a big improvement. And you have to celebrate the wins along the way to help people realize that like, we're actually making progress. We're not just like putting a bunch of activity. That's my perspective. I don't know, Chris, what do you think?
I mean, yeah, I agree with you. I think the other thing I would say is like, whenever you're doing something new, I always try to look for the qualitative stuff first, and mm-hmm. that usually shows up first. And so that could be surveys and stuff, but literally like if we're doing something completely new, we'll often say to the team, like, hey, let us know if this is coming up in sales calls, let us know if this is coming up in support, or like, let us know if you hear about something working or not. And it's funny, actually, we just had our offsite with the whole company in Chicago a couple weeks ago. And I was in this long conversation with someone on the team for 30 minutes. We're talking in their product strategy stuff, yep. like really, really in their stuff. I'm loving the conversation. And then he says, you know, I have a friend who just heard one of our ads on Freakonomics, because we had like some podcast advertising going. And that, like, they mentioned to me, they thought that was so cool. And that was an interesting thing. So it's like, okay, we turned on some new podcast advertising. I haven't looked at the data yet. It wasn't the first thing that he said, and this person's been at Wistia for years. It was almost like back of his mind, but calling that stuff up if you're doing something new and asking people the question like, hey, are you hearing about this? What kind of impact is it having? Often you can see the impact of things there first, and then over time it becomes, by the time it's showing up many cases, I think in many cases, quantitatively, it's been working for a long time, right? It's like the same thing of like, if you want to do A/B testing versus user testing, mm-hmm. you could go do show an interface to 20 people, and if they all love it, it's probably pretty good. But to get the statistical significance you need to prove that that interface is better, it might take months and months and months. And so the way to shortcut that often is like do the user testing, and then you feel like you have something that's really good, and then do it in the A/B testing.
The real kind of counterintuitive answer to that question of like, how do you get people to follow you on a long, hard journey? Which is I think the root of the question is like, do you guys know who Phil Stutz is, the famous psychiatrist? There's a documentary on him on Netflix.
Yes.
And Jonah
yes.
Hill and everything. He recently was on the Rich Roll podcast, and as a avid YouTube consumer, I was watching that because I like how Rich poses questions and does everything. And kind of in the opening, like 8 minutes of that podcast, I thought he had probably one of the most valuable 1 minutes I have consumed in a long time, which he's like, it's like, I don't know that much about life, but I know what I'm about to tell you is very true. And he was basically like, the way to success and happiness in life is the opposite of what most people think. Most people think that you need to take action. And if you take action, then you can then you can build some confidence. And then if you build that confidence, you can have like faith in what you're doing. And he's like, it's wrong. And this is me paraphrasing. It's like, it all starts with faith. Once you have faith, you can then take action. And then once you take action, that action gives you a result that can give you confidence. It's not that like you need to have confidence to get started. It is that you need to have faith to get started. And part of accomplishing a long, hard journey is that you yourself have to have faith, and you have to give that faith to everybody else. Like if you ask me, marketing is at a crisis of faith right now, which is like a very maybe controversial thing to say. It's like we've gotten so in love with like data and analytics and everything else that we have come to a crisis of faith of like, oh, don't we just kind of know based on some basic information that this will work? And shouldn't we have faith in ourselves, in our ability to actually do this well and that it will work? And not have to like do all these mini micro tests to prove that this thing might work versus just like, no, this thing is going to work. Let's just go and do it.
Yeah, you can't. Well, I was having a conversation with someone yesterday about this, and I was like, most great things were not built by pessimists.
Correct.
It's like, and I think it's really easy to tell someone why something isn't going to work. But actually, if you believe it could or should, then you find the path to make it work, right? And so, like, there's a reason why the people who build these massive things that are so successful or, you know, huge change in the world, they're finding a path to make it work, which is hard. And I think to your point, I I wouldn't have used that language exactly, but I think that makes perfect sense of like, you have to have a strong belief that that future is possible and that that thing will work, and then look for the evidence to like help you go on the journey faster and more aggressively.
Yep. Pessimists get to be right. Optimists get to be rich.
I like that too.
You know, yeah. That's one of my favorite quotes of all time.
I will never be rich.
Because I'm an optimist. But like, I think that's just, it does work out to be true most of the time.
Yeah, there's always reasons why stuff is not going to work, right?
Always.
You can always come up with reasons. That if you anchor to those things, then yeah, your stuff won't work. It's very simple.
Yeah, because you don't have faith. You don't have belief. Like you have to be able to will something into existence. That's what this world's about.
Can you develop a sense of faith over time?
Sure you can.
Okay. Then there's hope for
me. I think the most skeptical person can, because faith is buttressed and exists based on principles and beliefs, right? So if you're willing to get a series of principles that you're like, oh, I would not be skeptic or negative if these things were true, then you can say, oh, all right, in this situation, these things are true, so I am going to believe that this is going to work, right? And it's kind of the way to logic yourself out of your skepticism.
So what marketing tactics do you guys have faith in over the next 10 years?
I mean, I think we've been talking about a lot of the stuff that Kip is talking about and saying like, okay, what stuff works really well for us? Like, what can we do uniquely well?
Yes.
What is uniquely different? And it be that like opinions we can share, the quality of the things we're making, approaches to things. And like what we've come back to a lot is like a lot of the stuff that has always worked pre-internet era, it's always worked, is building really strong, unique brands with like a point of view. And so I think we've been marshaling the army horses. What's the analogy? We've been basically corralling the horses internally on like, hey, we're going to do much bigger brand campaigns that are hyper creative, lean into the stuff that Wistia does uniquely well. And a lot of our biggest brand campaigns that have done really well have also, like, the product has been like in part of the scene. Like it's been a part of the story. And so like an example for that is the documentary we did 1-10-100, where we did, you know, different budgets and the link. The thing that was so interesting about that is like, if you watch that documentary, you had to know what Soapbox was. Like, there was no missing that.
Totally.
And so we've been looking at things like that also, because to the point you're making, Kip, of like a lot of the performance marketing we've gotten used to with all this like data, where you know exactly how things are working, it's just much harder to get. You need more first party data. And so my bet is like brand is going to be even more important over the next 10 years. And I also think AI is going to erode general trust. So it's gonna be harder to earn trust, but if you can earn it, it'll be more valuable, basically. And so for me, that's like going, I think brand will be more important for us. It's gonna be very product-centric brand stuff. And then I think actually connecting with individuals is more important. And, you know, in a world of unlimited people and AIs and all that stuff, you have to believe like, okay, Kip, I trust Kip. He always has great advice on these different topics. I feel like I know Kip. Like, and that, I think that can anchor us towards like, I'm going to trust the advice that Kip gives more and the products that he has and all that kind of stuff, which I think was already happening. But I think that the kind of influencer revolution has created that opportunity as well. So those are two things I think are going to become more viable in the next 10 years.
I generally agree. I would say, you know, on the brand side, people used to trust brands and now people are the trusted brands.
Yeah.
Right. Like that's the switch that's happening. So creators and individuals, and even the individuals at a company, are the most important part, because it kind of is the Venn diagram of the brand focus and the personal connection focus. Right. And then you have offline events and other things that are part of that personal connection focus. AI is essentially automation 2.0. It's, you know, it's essentially goal-based automation with multiple steps versus rule-based automation. You know, and so what you will expect to see there is you should see massive improvements in conversion rates. So like in the second generation of the internet, most of your quantifiable gains that you could really direct, really like report out on, mostly came in how you acquired customers in, And the third generation of the internet is basically going to be like how you influence and monetize the customers that you do pull in. And then you're going to pull in those customers through creators, through brand, through personal engagements, through great storytelling, things that, you know, were really good in the 60s and 70s that are like coming like fully back around in manifesting on different channels and in different ways now.
Okay, I want to ask an in there question that is kind of
there.
Well, I don't know. Basically, I want to talk about the difference between having a platform that you market and having like the different point solutions.
Oh, this is a real question. This is somebody grappling with something kind of question.
Oh yes, it is. Well, it is. Let's be transparent. You know, we made the switch towards being a broader platform in like 2022, that's been great. And there's been a lot of really good stuff on the product side we've been able to do. Save people huge amounts of time by having all these, you know, the ability to edit, the ability to record, the ability to go live in one place. Mm-hmm. But there's a real challenge there of like, okay, how much do you market the point solutions themselves? Because that's often the customer problem that someone's looking to solve. It's like, hey, I want to put on a great live event. Okay, then we need them to understand Wistia Live, why it's different, yada, yada. But then there's also the ultimate connection of everything into the platform is where you can drive like enormous amounts of value, but people aren't necessarily searching from that for the get. So what advice do you have for me?
we're gonna do go-to-market therapy session. The first question I'd ask is what the motion to acquire the customer is. And I'll ask this more generically to everybody listening, which is like, you first want to say like, how are people coming in and buying my product initially? It is rare, unless you're a very big upmarket field and inside sales company, where people buy the whole platform right off the jump, right? And if that's the case, then cool. Then there's some product or products that people are coming to become customers of first. And so this is normally where people get frustrated. They're like, oh man, these two products, people buying these two products, but like, I want people to see this bigger story and I want people to buy this platform. But I also would like to make money. And if I don't make money, then people are never gonna see this like bigger platform and this bigger story, right? And so what you would say in this case is you would say, great, I'm going to, the one other weird variable here is, how different is the user and the buyer? Is the user and the buyer the same person? Are they one level removed from the organization? Or are they vastly different removed? The biggest challenge with the platform versus the kind of point solution is the platform is normally a functional buyer, a VP of marketing, VP of sales, something like that, depending on your software or your product in general. And then the product is normally, you know, a manager, frontline employee who wants to go and use the thing, right? And so I would say if you look at all the motions, one of the motions that tends to be the most successful is I acquire the user and get the decision maker involved in one of my core products, and then I have the right motion to expand and upsell those folks over time. If I can get them to see the value on those first products into these other products, and I build the products in the way that they're kind of really connected, and that becomes obvious. That's the sales and marketing motion. That's not the positioning. And you're like, well, how do I position that? And like at HubSpot, we sell a big customer platform. It's got a CRM, sales, marketing, customer success, operations hub, all these things. So it's like, somebody might come to us wanting to buy a marketing hub product, one of our most popular products. And it's like, the salesperson is going to say, you know, they will have maybe read some content, gotten some email nurturing, book a meeting with the sales rep. And the sales rep is going to say like, great. Before I tell you all about Marketing Hub product, I want you to know that at HubSpot, we have a really robust customer platform. These are the use cases and problems we solve across that customer platform. And one of the great things about HubSpot is that you can grow with us, that we're not just about marketing, we're bigger than that. Now, I understand you're really focused on generating leads in your marketing right now. So let me go and walk you through our Marketing Hub product and get a better understanding of your challenges. And that way you're introducing that platform positioning at a rep level, and you also are doing it probably at a brand campaign level, on the product detail pages of your website. You're kind of cascading that through, because what you're trying to do is make that a long-term game of inception. You can't ask somebody to learn something really broad really fast. It's just impossible. And so what you're trying to say is like, oh, over a period of time, I want people to slowly know that we're actually this different thing, right? And not even a different thing, but a bigger thing than how they currently think of us.
Marketing. So you're saying,
yeah, incept them over time, but really get like solve the frame what the long-term opportunity is up front, but give them like solve the exact problem they're coming in for that day.
Solve that initial pain, make sure they get value, and make sure that there's a clear integration between that solving that initial pain to the broader platform, the bigger product opportunity they have to be and partner with you all on.
That makes sense. That's good advice for anyone who would need that advice.
I don't know who would, but if you do, that's great. Yeah.
How big is your organization at HubSpot? Like how many people?
My marketing team?
Yeah.
I think we're like 550 people, something like that.
550 people.
Yeah.
How many sales reps are there?
Oh, a few thousand. I don't know.
A few thousand.
Yeah.
And are you like digging at your scale? Are you still digging in and saying like, hey, I want to see the deck that the sales reps are presenting?
Oh, totally.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's like a really, I mean, that's what I was picking up on in that answer. But I think it's a really interesting thing that across where we're talking, let's say 2,500, 3,000 people, you're influencing like how folks are thinking about like presenting to the customer day to day, what the message is and stuff like that. Is that kind of what you, how you thought it would be when you took on this role like 9 years ago? Is that what you think everybody should do?
I had no idea what I thought. I didn't know what I was getting myself into. I think the common perception is like, oh, this can be less top down. And the reality is it can't. Like the reality is that like more people, more clarity, right? Like, the more people you have involved in telling a story, this could be people who work for you, this could be advocates out in the world, partners, could be whoever, like the more clarity you have to pass them. And clear, the one thing I can ensure is true is that no clarity has ever come from a consensus committee. Nobody has ever done something super clear by consensus and by committee. And so you have to be more top down and not like prescriptive, but like clear on what the goal is and clear on how we're solving the problem. And ultimately like a final decision maker on like, this is the right messaging. These are the right words that people are actually going to understand and why they are the way they are.
So you're making it clear like, hey, on this type of thing, if there's going to be a big change, like I need to know about it or like you need to bring me the data. And that's how you're able to have like this very tight, communication, this tight approach, this deep understanding of what's working, even at the scale that you're at, is by having like the really clear like swim lanes of like, hey, when you're in this lane, I need to know what's up. I'm going to give feedback. We need this to be on point across the entire organization, and we're going to tweak it and we're going to adjust it, obviously, over time. It's just really interesting to me because I that makes sense. It seems like that's hard to do in practice with that many people, but maybe it's not. I don't know.
Nothing that you think is important should be hard, right? It's just a priority. Just you have to, it's like an imperative that it has to happen. And so you figure out how to make it easy because it has to happen over and over again. The other thing is, I think it's hard if you're not a craftsperson. Like if you don't understand the craft, it's actually very, very hard.
Oh,
like
yeah.
If you don't understand that, like, how the production of a YouTube short works or how like the mechanics of an RSS feed or all of those things, like it actually gets very hard. Or like how CMSs work, all those things, like it is very hard. I do all that stuff. And like the reason I, you know, Kieran and I do Marketing Against the Grain and we do a 2-episode-a-week YouTube and show and podcast is so that it forces us to be really, really good at understanding how everything works. It's one of the many reasons why I think it's good. Because you have to understand how things like come to life in the world, not just the decisions you're making.
Well, yeah, it's just interesting because it's something that like I've certainly noticed is if you want to build a world-class team, and by build, I mean specifically like you're going to take risks on people, you want them to grow, you want them to like take you to places and themselves to places where they haven't been before. People need to be constantly growing and stretching. And one of the challenges with like senior hires is sometimes you can find someone who can like talk the talk, but they can't get in the weeds and like walk the walk. And I think it's a really like common mistake that people make is like, as you said, like being able to be the craftsperson, like dig in on the details, like you should be able to lead from the front and get into the details and show someone how to write great copy on something or give feedback on design or, you know, product manage, whatever the job is. And also to do it at scale, you have to be a great manager and communicator, and you need both those things. And I think it's just very, I think it's a really classic mistake for folks that they don't, they miss the part where the person is actually like, would be a world-class IC.
That's the thing. It's like I played golf with, I believe, our mutual friend, Dave Gerhart. I think you know Dave.
Yeah.
And afterwards we were talking, and he was kind of like, I think he was trying to see if I'm still in the game. And he was like, you know, he was like, he's like, all right, tell me how to like fix my search traffic on exit 5. And I was like, Dave, how many members you have? He's like, oh, you know, X, Y, and Z. I was like, how many visits do you need? Oh, like this. And I was like, you don't have public profiles for those members. Just ranking for their names would give you that many visits. It'd be like, it would be like 1.7 visits per person. That's easy on a monthly basis, you know? And it's like, you have to be in the weeds of like how you would do that, do those things at a very tactical level to like actually grow, because that's the, without that, you never get anywhere. Like, you have to be obsessed with like, what's the goal and how do I back my way into like actually accomplishing it?
Still in the game.
Wow. Awesome.
I'm trying. It's hard. It's hard some days, but we're getting there.
Okay. We're going to go into the last segment of the show, which is a rapid fire segment. Here we go.
Let's do it.
If you're hiring a marketer to join your team, what's one of the first interview questions you ask them?
If you were in a room with 300 people, what would be the one thing that you would be verifiably better at than those 300 people?
You like that one, Sophie?
I like it.
I can tell you like that. Date, marry, kill with social media platforms, TikTok, YouTube, Instagram.
I'm going to marry YouTube. I'm going to date Instagram. I'm going to have to kill TikTok because the regulators might kill it anyway.
There you go. What's the last product you bought because you liked their ad?
Oh, gosh. A lot of things, I'm sure. I love marketers are the most influenced by marketing. I'm trying to think what like a good I'm trying to think what's the best example of this is. I don't know if it's ads, but like I bought the Kane shoes, which are like these recovery outdoor like foam shoes, because they've been doing a bunch of good creator stuff. So that's probably my last like marketing influence purchase. They're great.
Okay. Product. And you like them.
They're great. Yeah.
That's great. What's a must-read book for marketers?
Well, that's a hard question. I'll give you two. I think it's Ogilvy on Advertising is still great. And then I'm going to have to look at David Senroff from Founders, awesome dude, awesome podcast. If folks do not listen to the Founders podcast, did an episode on like, it's a book called The History of the World. And it's like this 100-page book that these two professors wrote about like basically how the world works and like the incentives and why the world is the way it is. And if you're going to be great at marketing, you need to know that.
I love
that. It's a great
book. Kip, that is it. Thank you so much for joining us. This has been super fun. Obviously, it could have gone much longer, much deeper, and I could have asked for more direct advice, which I'll do next time. So
we'll do it again sometime. Everybody, before you hit stop on your media player, you can now turn the volume back up because Chris and I are off off your eardrums, and we'll be a little quieter whatever you're listening to next.
So really appreciate you being here. Where can people best connect with you?
You can find me on Marketing Against the Grain, which is on YouTube and anywhere you get your podcasts. You can find me on LinkedIn at Kip Bodner on X, Twitter, whatever we're calling it these days, and that's where you can find me.
Awesome. Thank you, sir. Nothing like a good old go-to-market therapy session, you know? Just really letting it all out there.
The doctor was in.
The doctor was in. Obviously, I love talking about platforms versus point solutions. Hit very close to home.
Yeah, Wistia's having a moment.
We're trying, you know, I'm always trying to learn. And I'm learning publicly. That's one of the things we're doing here on the show. That was just like so helpful and insightful to hear the way that he like thinks through that. I also have found myself really reflecting on just the like, where is marketing going and what are the implications here? This one thing just keeps staying on my mind, which is if you look forward, you know, what have been the trends of where we've been? Like, brand is becoming more important because we have less data to track things. So we have less data until someone actually hits our website and is using our product. And I think there's huge implications in that. And the point that Kip made around conversion, how we should expect conversion goes way up. And that's interesting because I think a lot of people are so used to numbers actually going down, you know, as like, oh, harder to track, harder to see. The idea that you're going to have this explosion up is actually surprising. And I think that it makes perfect sense. And I do think it will happen. And it's just this continuation, actually, of something that's been happening for 10 years, which is product taking on more commercial responsibility and having more data and more testing and innovation, and AI is going to accelerate that. And the other side, if you can't do things that are really interesting and stand out and get people's attention, then you're going to have a lot more trouble marketing in the future.
Yeah, I think related to that, the other thing that really jumped out at me is something that Kip said and something that I think you say all the time is that like people often underestimate how big the opportunities are.
Yeah.
And yeah, I don't know. That just like, it blows me away to like have that perspective and like going into it with that like sort of like expansive mindset. It can really change the game. It can really change how you like pave the way to success. So
I think that's exactly right. It's like most people underestimate the importance of early customers and just what that means for how far things can go. And it is like when you unlock that, you can seem a little crazy, I think, because like we see this a lot. There's like the crazy thing of like, well, I have this small number of users. This could be huge. We're like, really? It could be huge. And I was like, well, humans are actually pretty similar and like the same things. And like, if you can save people time or delight them in some way or let them do something that you couldn't do otherwise, and you can get 100 people to do that or 1,000, like chances are you can get 10,000, you can get 100,000, you can get 1,000,000. It just might take a long time.
Yeah. Well, like we said in the interview, optimists get to be rich, pessimists get to be right.
There you go. Hard not to end on that. So I'm an optimist, and I'd say, if you like the show, like and subscribe to the show. We've been broadening the platforms where you can see this. So you can watch on wiz.com on the Talking to That page. You can watch on YouTube now. You can also watch on Spotify.
It's a big one. Spotify is a big one.
Please keep the feedback coming. In particular, if you have guests that you want us to chat with, we love when you tell us about guests. You can just message us on LinkedIn. I keep getting more messages from Talking Too Loud listeners and viewers, which is awesome. You can also email us if you prefer email at ttlpod@wiz.com. And I think that's it. Is that it, Sylvie?
That's all she wrote.
We've done it. All right. Thanks, everybody. Good to see you. We'll see you soon.
Talking Too Loud is brought to you by Wistia. Hosted by Chris Savage, produced by me, Sylvie Lubau, along with Adam Day. Executive produced by Wistia Studios. This episode was mixed by Maria Passingham of Edit Audio. Listen to Talking Too Loud wherever you listen to podcasts. And hey, rate and review us wherever you listen. And check out more content from Wistia Studios at wistia.com.